dudes in the butt.
Oh, man.
Dudes in the butt. She got dudes in the butt. Dudes in the butt. Dudes. Dudes.
In the butt.
Duty dudes. In the booty doo. The booty who.
Booty who.
Booty hooty dudes in the butt. Yeah.
That one.
Yeah?
That one.
That one?
Men in the behind.
What is life? What is happening?
I don't know.
What is crappening?
I haven't been able to answer that question for a couple days.
That was my ankle that just made that noise.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
I need to get all those batteries. My brain's not here. I'm here. This guy's not, though.
Well, you know.
You know.
You just get to
physically
listen
yes.
and be punchy.
Emotionally and spiritually, no.
Punchy.
Not like physically punchy, but like punchy.
Punchy is a
like...
stretch.
Too might tired. Be like a, too tired for punch?
Like a wet kind of a thing, you know?
Yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wet right. slanket.
A wet slanket.
Yeah.
Yep.
Did you do the thing? Did you press the button?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did.
Well, I hope you all enjoyed that conversation.
I didn't, and I was here.
Well, shit. Welcome to Ghosts and Hoes.
Ghosts and Hoes.
Ghosts and Hoes, a paranormal podcast where we talk about all things spooky, cryptids,
yeah.
aliens,
yeah.
motherfucking witchcraft,
uh-huh.
murder most motherfucking foul.
Most especially.
And that one time, haunted bunk beds. Yeah. So, yeah. Hey, I'm Dee.
I'm Z.
There's Randall on the ones and twos, kind of.
Hello.
Physically, yes. Again.
I'm physically in the room.
Mentally,
he traveled and am tired.
I have not slept more than 3.5 hours each night for the last 3 days.
Yeah, no, that would fuck me up.
I am real fucked up. I'm supposed to go do a thing in like 45 minutes, but I don't know, man.
I don't know, man. I don't know about that. But, hey, do we have any backhoes?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
Okay, a couple.
You looked like you weren't sure, and then, yeah.
I was maybe disassociating a little and then came back into my body when I realized you would ask me a question.
All right.
I was like, oh, yeah. Sure. First of all, a big fat rest in piss to Henry Kissinger.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
He finally died.
Mm-hmm. Rest in piss.
Rest in piss. And according to Anthony Bourdain, in his 2001 memoir, he said, and I joyously quote, "Once you've been to Cambodia, you'll never stop wanting to beat Henry Kissinger to death with your bare hands." If you don't know who he is... go Google. He was
the gigs.
A fucking monster
yeah.
who somehow got to live to 100 years old.
Yeah, I saw on the clock app there's a lot of little videos.
Oh, yeah.
Anthony Bourdain waiting in heaven.
Yeah.
Kissinger walks in, comes in with the right hook.
Bam.
Yeah.
He's burning in hell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, there was one, and I can't remember now which paper publication wrote it, but the title of their article was something along the lines of "Henry Kissinger has finally died." I was like, yeah,
finally.
That's great. I love that. Sorry, the next one is sorry to all the Patroon members having difficulties with the fucking...
Did we fix that?
Not yet. Okay. This month's Patroon. But by the time you're listening to it, we'll have gotten it fixed.
Probably.
But Patreon is a fucking glitchy little gremlin that likes to do things nobody asked of it.
Glitchy I'm going to take
shit.
A look right now.
A glitchy little
you're gonna hear,
gremlin.
You're going to hear this in real time, everybody.
Oh, no. Nobody needs to hear that. Also, just a heads up.
Heads up.
Next week's episode will be the last one of the year.
Wow.
Or the last new one of the year, because holiday shit.
Oh, yeah.
But don't worry, because we're going to be releasing a couple of patroons, and then we'll be back with brand new episodes starting on January 10th.
Yeah!
Oh, yeah, there's that. Also,
Yeah! Please. Yeah! Oh, Prongles.
Yeah.
You brought prongs.
I brought some prongles. It's been a long time since we've had some poingies.
I see.
There's flavors.
I see prongles.
There's prongles. Which one do you want first, pink or brown?
The one that's pink looks like it's going to be upsetting.
No, unless you don't like spicy things.
I love spicy things. Pink to me usually implies like shrimp.
Oh no, I get that, but yeah. No, it's habanero flavored.
Oh hell yeah!
All right,
yeah. I think I found these at either the Walmart or the Target.
All right. Prongles.
Yeah.
Prongle away.
Some poingies.
I love a good prongle.
Ooh, they smell spicy.
And I have no liquids.
Oh, no.
Well, I came straight from
the
job.
Still. Goo.
All right. Here come some prongles.
Here they come. I got them.
You got them.
Here come
ooh, prongles. The
prongles. They smell spicy.
We do got prongles.
We do got prongles.
Goo.
3, 2, 1.
Ready? Oh, sorry, I'm kicking shit. I kicked the table.
Woo. Those are nice.
Those are really nice.
Not too spicy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a good tang.
It's a nice little ride.
I like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's got a good tang. What's next?
If you see them, get them.
G&H approved.
Mm-hmm. I want to see if you can guess what these ones are.
Okay.
Okay.
Struggle bus?
The prongles strike back is what was happening.
I'm reaching for the prongles. Okay, now I'm going to mel them.
Here, you want a prongle?
How the fuck? Okay. Yes, please.
Oh, interesting.
Patreon is a goddamn demon, everybody.
Ooh. It's a familiar smell.
Oh, God. Gross.
It smells like a Mississippi pot roast to me, but...
I get that. All right.
It smells like pot roast.
That's not...
It smells like pot roast if it was a dog food flavor.
Ew!
Dog food pot roast.
Ah.
Huh.
It tastes better than the smell. That's not saying a whole lot.
Well...
They do have a smell of wet dog food, but...
I'm going to say overcooked brisket. Is it overcooked brisket?
It is not.
Mm.
You sticking with pot roast?
Yeah, I got nothing.
Chili cheese fries.
Ah.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah. Those ones, you don't need to. You don't need to.
Eh. I don't hate them.
No. But I don't love them.
No.
The habanero ones, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Get those if you see them. These, you don't gotta.
Yeah.
They're...
Well, I haven't eaten in several hours, so, I mean, it's titted me over.
It's titted you over?
It's titted me over.
There you go.
Yep. All right. Perfect. Well, shit.
Yeah.
Let's do this. You go first, yeah?
I do, indeed.
Neat.
One second. I have to...
1 second. Bee-boo-bee-ba-bee-boo-bee.
I was just trying to figure out where I was gonna...
Where you're gonna stop?
Yeah.
And shit?
Oh, there it is.
Oh, good.
I knew it was around here somewhere.
Love that.
Found it. Nailed Great. It. Because unlike last week's story, this one is not short.
It's not a short McGort.
It is not. It's not a cute, dainty little... Lady Mm-mm. story.
It's not a one paper.
It's not. So it's going to be a two part. You're welcome.
All right.
And to start, this is going to sound insane out of context.
Great.
But one, consider the source.
Fair.
And two, I will get there.
All right.
So you know how I love Tubi?
Yeah.
The streaming app?
Yeah. Actually, I do.
Great. The only thing I don't love about it is how it automatically starts playing a movie if you take a little bit too long while you're, like, watching the trailer or reading the description of the movie. It just will automatically start playing.
Oh, yeah, I would hate that.
Yeah, it is very annoying. I don't like to be rushed. Tubi?
Yeah.
Don't rush me.
No.
Don't rush my choices.
No.
It's like, it's a minor thing, but it still is very annoying. But anyway, the other night, I was scrolling through all the movies I have saved in my watch list, and took too long for Tubi's liking. And it made the choice to start the movie for me, mm-hmm. like it has in the past. Mm-hmm. And unlike countless times this happened in the past, I decided that Tubi was actually right this time.
Oh, I was like, good.
Yes, you've made a good choice, Tubi.
Good job.
I'll give you this one. Had I seen this movie 1,000 times before? Yes. Had it been ages since my last viewing? Most definitely. Had I also forgotten that it was based on a true story that's been turned into or inspired several movies that I'll mention eventually? And that's why I'm giving you this preamble today? Hundo P. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. And I'm very excited. Because now that I've gotten that out of the way, today I'm going to tell y'all about the murder of Kirsten Costas.
All right.
But you won't get to find out what movie until next week.
Well, so that just means you got to tune in next week.
Mm-hmm. So, Kirsten...
Get some prongles.
Oh, yeah. Get some prongles. Kirsten Marina Costas was born on July 23rd, 1968, to parents Arthur, a.k.a. Art, and Barrett Costas, an executive for 3M and a homemaker, respectively. A few years later, the family welcomed another child, a son named Peter. Prior to having kids, Art and Barrett had decided to move from Oakland to the Northern California suburb of Orinda, which is roughly 30 minutes from downtown San Francisco, as the Contra Costa County town was known for having good schools and was regarded as a safe area to raise a family. The affluent Costas family fit right in with the rest of the residents, and eventually they'd all become members of the nearby Meadow Swim and Tennis Club. Carol Pogash summed up the city in an article from 1985 by writing, quote, "With a median household income of $60,000, the area's families are not upwardly mobile. Living in Orinda certifies that they have already arrived." Hmm. And again, this story takes place in the 80s, so...
I was going to say 60 grand, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. But it, again, was the 80s. And just so you get a feel for where we're at, there's that quote. And honestly, picture literally the backdrop to any 80s teen movie, and you get the basic idea. Sunny, warm, all the popular kids drive BMWs, parents play tennis and golf, you know, that old chestnut.
Oh, I'm aware.
I know, that's not far from your stomping grounds.
All the snooty
mm-hmm.
club kids lived in Orinda.
Yep. In any event, the Costas family were known to be relatively quiet and keep to themselves, except for Kirsten, who, according to her mother, was, quote, "the energy of the house. She was always listening to music, making phone calls, dancing. She was full of life. We're simple people. She was raring to go, ready to start to live her life when it was snuffed out."
Boo.
Big time. According to family friend Sue Morrow, Sue Morrow,
like tomorrow.
Yeah, I hadn't said it out loud until right now. According to Sue, Kirsten was, quote, "cute, not beautiful, an all-American girl, more like a Sports Illustrated swimsuit model than a Playboy type."
Okay.
She also, in another interview, called her cute as a bug's ear, which I hadn't heard probably since the 80s.
Fair.
Kirsten was not the stereotypical blonde you'd probably pictured, by the way. Her grandmother on her father's side was Greek or Greek-American, giving Kirsten her curly brown hair and, quote, "beautiful olive skin." She loved skiing, swimming, gymnastics, and dance. In 1984, she was a sophomore at Miramonte High School and part of what some fellow students dubbed as the loud crowd.
Oh.
A.K.A. the popular kids.
The loud crowd.
The loud crowd. At the time, 15-year-old Kirsten was on the school's varsity swim team. She was part of the yearbook staff, she was a student worker in the office, and was also a great student. In the words of a classmate, quote, "everyone wanted to be like her." She had also been made a member of the school's exclusive borderline sorority known as the Bobolinks.
Oh.
A.K.A. the Bobbies. The group would later be described by then-Miramonte High School principal Bran Yeish as, quote, a group of students from several high schools, including Miramonte, that held various events, such as car washes and cake sales, to raise money for the Mount Diablo Therapy Center.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was just like, I want to say, like, an exclusive club of candy stripers.
Yeah.
Almost, because that they just did all kinds of volunteer work for a local hospital, which is great.
Yeah.
So, all that to say, homegirl was busy.
Yeah.
And generally well-liked by friends and classmates, who remembered her as, quote, fashionable, pretty and vibrant, witty, outgoing, confident, and sarcastic. And that she, quote, had a good personality and was good at everything.
All right.
Which would make what happened to her all the more shocking, but I will get there. Despite already having a whole lot going for her, there was one thing that Kirsten wanted more than anything, and that was to be a cheerleader. Her friend Jessica Grant would share that the sport was, quote, taken really seriously, with writer Carol Pogash adding, quote, before trying out, applicants write essays explaining what they could add to the school. Parents sign an agreement to spend $500 to pay for green and white uniforms and for cheerleading camp.
Damn.
Goo. That's a lot.
In the 80s, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
A whole hell of a lot. She practiced the routines religiously ahead of tryouts, and her hard work paid off.
Oh, shit.
According to one of the 20 judges.
I'm getting a look.
You both need to calm the fuck down immediately. You need to calm down your face, which is fun coming from me.
Mm-hmm. Patreon's up.
There you go. I told you by the time you listen to this, it would be ready.
Yeah.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah. So, yes, according to one of 20 judges for the cheerleading squad, Kirsten was, quote, a perfect cheerleader. The results of said tryouts were given in what sounds like an assembly, which feels very much like a product of its time and location.
What year was it?
84. And all of the young ladies that had tried out and made the squad were called onto the stage where they received flowers and plenty of praise.
I had to look. It's $1,400 today.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that sounds accurate for school sports. Maybe even a little low.
Yeah.
These days. I don't know. I haven't been in high school for a long time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so they had like a weird little assembly to announce all of the people that had made it onto the cheerleading squad.
Wow.
Which I don't think that's how it happened anywhere outside of California.
Very 80s.
I got a phone call
when
I had tried out for cheerleading to tell me that I had not made the squad because I was not peppy enough. Which is fair. It is fair. Like, yeah.
You just, you know, you're lacking in the pep department.
Well, yeah. And at the time, even then, I was like, oh, you know, you're right. That's okay. I mean, I did it because I was small.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be on dance team because this is going to make me sound like an asshole, but I knew more than all of the girls on the dance team.
Oh.
But see, it's because I grew up as a competitive dancer. So I was like, I did end up doing dance team. And then they always asked me to teach everything. So, you know. But yeah, I was not peppy enough to be a cheerleader, which
fair
is spot on.
Yeah, it's fair. Like, that's fair.
Yeah, okay. But yeah, they just called. They didn't make a spectacle.
Yeah.
Which I feel like also didn't help later on down the road.
Oh, okay.
But eventually, I will get there. So, that whole thing happens, you know, which, of course, leaves the girls who hadn't made the team trying to keep it together while surrounded by an audience of fellow teenagers, whomst we all know from personal experiences can be quite cruel when the mood strikes. Especially when we remember that teenage girls are demons. So there's that.
Oh, yeah.
That said, 15-year-old Kirsten had made the varsity squad and would be on the field cheering when school started back up in the fall, since it seems that tryouts were held near the end of the school year. Uh-huh. She planned on spending the summer, as any teenager would, hanging out with her friends, turning 16, and going to cheer camp. Sadly, despite forever being associated with the sport, Kirsten Costas would never actually get to fulfill her dream of being a cheerleader.
Right, right.
On June 21st, 1984, Kirsten's mother, Barrett, received a phone call. The girl on the other line identified herself as a fellow Bobby and informed her that she knew Kirsten was still at cheer camp, which was being held at St. Mary's College in the nearby city of Moraga. But she wanted to let her know that Kirsten had been invited to a secret initiation dinner on Saturday the 23rd that only a select few of the new bobolinks recruits were being asked to attend.
Huh.
The caller, who never gave their name, repeatedly reminded Barrett that the event was a secret and asked that she refrain from mentioning it to anyone except for Kirsten.
Huh.
Suspect and highly questionable. She then let her know that someone would come pick Kirsten up at her house around 8:30 that Saturday evening to take her to the dinner. Not thinking much of the whole phone call or plan, because it's, you know, a high school sorority for all intents and purposes. She's like, oh, yeah, okay. Initiation, sure. Whatever. So she's like, yeah, all right, okay. When Kirsten got home, Barrett told her about it. She's like, you know, cheer camp, that was fun for you. Now guess what? You get to go to a fancy secret dinner, I guess. And she was like, great, okay. That same evening, Art, Barrett, and Peter had plans to attend a potluck dinner for Peter's Little League team. And they had already left by the time Kirsten's mysterious ride was scheduled to pick her up for her own event. Knowing this, Barrett called home beforehand to tell Kirsten to leave the porch light on, and that she loved her and to have fun.
Okay.
It was the last time she'd ever speak to her only daughter.
Oof.
Yeah. Almost right on the dot, a car honked outside of Kirsten's home on Orchard Road. She went outside to find a mustard yellow Pinto waiting for her. Some sources say it was orange. Some say it was gold.
Either way, it was a Pinto.
Either way, it was a oddly colored Pinto. So, I can imagine walking out and being like, the fuck?
Right.
So, she got into the car, and off they went. About an hour later, Moraga residents Alex and Mary Jane Arnold had their game of Pinochle that they'd been playing with their neighbors interrupted by an unexpected ring of the doorbell. Even more surprising was the culprit, 15-year-old Kirsten Costas. Some reports say that the Arnolds were friends of her parents, but others state that they had no connection at all, which I am more inclined to believe. A lot of the newspaper articles that I found from the time were just like, we didn't know her.
Okay.
So, how they got named as her parents' friends, I'm not sure, but it might have had something to do with the movie that later came out. So anyway, she shows up on their front step, and she was just like, hi, friends. Which, you know, a 15-year-old girl just showing up on your door in the night.
Yeah.
Like, almost 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
Jarring.
Yeah, something's wrong.
And weird. You're like, I don't feel comfortable. But according to the Arnold's later testimony, Kirsten wasn't alone, and that another girl was, quote, lurking out the path behind her. So Kirsten was at the front door, and she was, like,
back on the path.
Back on, like, the sidewalk, basically, just kind of, like, creeping. Kirsten, who Alex recalled looking, quote, tense but not terrified, told the couple that she was okay. They asked her, you know, is everything okay? And she's like, I'm all right. But my friend got weird on me, she said.
Okay.
Friend got weird on me. She asked if she could use their phone to call her parents, which they were more than happy to let her do. Unfortunately, they were still out at Peter's Little League dinner. Uh-huh. But because it was the 80s, Alex offered to give the teen a ride home.
Okay.
According to Google Maps, Moraga is less than 10-minute drive to Orinda.
Uh-huh.
By the way, I didn't know his address, so I couldn't look up, like, exactly
where
it was.
So it's close.
It was a short little drive.
Uh-huh.
So they got into his car, and as he's pulling out of the driveway, he notices the Pinto parked nearby. And as they drove towards Kirsten's neighborhood, the Pinto seemingly followed.
Huh.
Alex pointed this out, but Kirsten didn't seem too worried, allegedly telling him that it was her friend's car and she just hadn't wanted to get back in with her. Because, again, Friend got weird. For the rest of the short ride, he describes Kirsten as, quote, talkative and calm, adding that she told him all about school and her social life.
Okay.
Which, all right. Soon enough, they arrive at Kirsten's house, but since her parents still weren't home, she said that she was going to go wait for them at a neighbor's house.
Okay.
And because he seems like a solid dude, Alex tells her that he'll wait to leave until she gets inside.
Uh-huh.
Always do that, by the way. Uh-huh. If you're dropping someone off, friend, whatever, just wait until they get inside.
Yeah.
That's just a decent thing to do. As she's walking up to the neighbor's front door, he sees another girl rushing towards Kirsten, who yelled at the other girl to go away, and that she was, quote, so weird.
Ew.
The girl would later be described as, quote, chunky, stringy-haired, and she was a round-faced blonde wearing a yellow shirt and faded red sweatpants.
Okay.
Yeah. The unknown girl then begins what Alex assumes was a fist fight.
Oh, shit.
Then he saw a flash of something silver. Kirsten was knocked to the ground, but quickly got back to her feet. The unknown attacker ran to the Pinto and took off. Alex, once again trying to be a righteous dude, takes off after the Pinto in his car, but gives up the chase after about a half mile, I think, and decides to go back to check on Kirsten.
Mm-hmm.
While he's gone, trying to chase down this girl and her hideous Pinto, neighbor Arthur Hillman, who had known Kirsten since she was a baby,
uh-huh,
rushes outside after hearing a blood-curdling scream.
Oh, boy.
To find Kirsten staggering towards him as she screamed, quote, help me, I've been stabbed, before collapsing in his arms.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it's bad. He yells for one of his sons to call an ambulance, which quickly arrives on the scene. While he waits, he asks Kirsten who stabbed her, but she just repeated, I can't breathe.
Yeah, pierced her lung, sounds like.
Yeah. Shortly after the ambulance and the police arrive, the rest of the Costas family pull into the neighborhood.
Oh, shit.
And are shocked to learn that the chaos on their street is due to their own daughter's attack.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, when they got back, it was to see her in the ambulance, which she is put into and rushed to the nearby hospital. But an hour later, she was pronounced dead.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. She had been stabbed a total of 5 times.
Oof.
Including 2 13-centimeter-long gashes on her back.
Yikes.
That is quite large.
Yeah.
That's big.
Yeah.
That's a big stab.
Yeah.
Which those 2 wounds resulted in both of her lungs being punctured and her liver being lacerated.
Jesus.
One of the 2 stab wounds to the front of her body was 15.5 centimeters long and, quote, penetrated the left upper arm, chest, and left lung.
God.
While it's reported that, quote, any one of the 3 deeper wounds would have caused death by itself, end quote, it was the bisected major artery leading to her heart that ultimately killed her.
That's fucked up.
Super fucked. Kirsten's classmates would later plant a magnolia tree in front of the Miramonte High School in her honor. Her funeral was held 5 days after her death at the Lafayette Orinda Presbyterian Church, where hundreds of people who had known and loved Kirsten gathered to remember her too short life. However, not everyone in attendance had loved Kirsten, as the Arinda community would find out later, because her killer was there too.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
ballsy.
Shit. Yeah.
Ballsy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's, I hate wow. it. Everyone in the community had assumed that the culprit would be caught almost immediately. There were eyewitnesses who had seen and even briefly spoken to the killer, not to mention the beat-up, very loud, both in color and mechanically, out-of-place Pinto she'd been driving that night.
Uh-huh.
Teenage girls were frequently spotted in pairs or groups due to the looming fear that the killer was still out there waiting to strike again. Sharon Palmer, the mother of one of Kirsten's friends, shared that some kids were sleeping with the lights on or even with their parents in the wake of the crime, adding, quote, "I was afraid to let my daughter go anywhere. How could anyone when this adorable girl that everyone loved got stabbed?"
Yeah.
Friends and neighbors came up with a $50,000 reward fund for any information, and signs featuring a description of the killer were placed in almost every store in town. Of course, rumors started to spread. The murder had been committed in a PCP-fueled rage, or was some kind of satanic ritual sacrifice.
Yeah.
Remember, this is around the height of the satanic panic, so of course that was going to get thrown out there one point. Investigators began interviewing students, and eventually would end up conducting over 300 interviews, checked into at least 1,000 leads, and examined over 700 Ford Pintos in the area.
Wow.
I cannot imagine any of those being directly in Arinda at the time, considering the students drove nicer cars than the teachers.
Yeah.
Well, then maybe the teachers had the Pintos. But I don't know if they could afford to live directly in Arinda. I don't know. But it did not seem like a very common car to be in the area, like the direct area at the time. But apparently there were at least 750 was the number, which is so many Pintos. Too many?
That's a lot of Pintos.
It's a lot. According to Lieutenant James Robinson, quote, "A number of people have called saying they think they have seen the suspect. Other people have called saying they have feelings about people who might be the suspect." There have also been psychic calls. The calls have come from all over. We're checking out all leads. As the summer passed, classmates started coming up with their own conclusions as to who was responsible for Kirsten's murder, and all seemingly agreed on one person.
Oh.
Fellow student Nancy Kane. As the story goes, Nancy had previously been part of the popular crowd, but at one point or another, she decided it just wasn't for her anymore and turned into a, quote, goth.
Oh.
Hmm. Nancy had allegedly been selected to join the Bobbies, but she turned them down. And Kirsten and her friends picked on Nancy because she was different.
Ah, yeah.
And fellow students even went so far as to allege that Nancy had yelled, "If you don't shut up, I'm going to kill you," to Kirsten during their shared biology class once.
Oh, well.
Yeah. Nancy, however, says that never happened. She would later write an essay for school which read, quote, "The whole town of Arinda seemed to want me to feel bad because I had dyed my hair and I was not part of the social scene. This is what I was guilty of in reality. I was guilty of being myself, but I will not change."
Okay.
Which, fucking good. Fair. The bullying and harassment that Nancy endured from students and their parents alike after Kirsten's murder became so bad that she transferred schools. In a 2015 interview, Nancy said, words
are hard.
They're very hard on this day. She shed some insight into her life and relationship with Kirsten, saying, quote, "Just to set the record straight, I was not goth. I was new wave."
True.
There's a big difference.
There's a huge difference.
Just entirely hugely different things. Yeah. So.
Yes.
I love how that's, she started the interview. "Just to set the record straight, I was not a goth. I was new wave." I love that for you, Nancy.
Yeah. Big difference.
Big. Back to her quote. I was
right there with her.
I liked Madonna, Culture Club, Flock of Seagulls, Duran Duran, etc., bands like that. I wouldn't call Miramonte cruel, but it was hard to keep up with the Joneses. It was super competitive in every way. I was lucky my dad was a doctor and we had money. Middle class didn't work in Orinda. Orinda wasn't super rich, but it was definitely a town where most people lived a comfortable life. I think a lot of what was going on was simple teenage angst. We are all discovering who we are or who we think we are. There were so many cliques, and we're not told to be nice to each other like they do in school now. Uh-huh. Everyone played a sport or had a thing, skiing, tennis, golf. I rode horses along with another very wealthy friend. There was also the Orinda Country Club. Not everyone belonged, and it was super prestigious to belong. Kirsten and I did not interact that much because I didn't like her. I don't think she liked me either. I had changed so much and had kind of a druggy, dark reputation that I created because I thought it was cool. We had a few classes together, but there was no war being waged. She was popular, chatty, cute, and social. That whole scene bothered me. Or that whole scene bored me. I just rejected it, which wasn't normal for an Orinda girl. We were all mean at some point. So yes, she was mean and snotty and thought she was better than other people. We were taught to be that way. Conceited. I thought I was better than them. I don't think Kirsten was mean as much as she was cocky. She just had a lot of self-esteem. Some kids are like that. She did well in everything she tried. She wasn't mean to everybody. Everyone was bullied by someone. That's how life is.
Yeah.
Which, yeah, especially then.
Yeah.
So investigators looked into Nancy as a suspect and asked her to submit to a polygraph test. Again, remember, it was the 80s. Uh-huh. But her mother refused to allow it. She's like, absolutely not. Huh. No, because again, she was a minor.
Right.
And they're like, her mom's like, yeah, no. No, thank you. And it turned out to be unnecessary, though, because Nancy had a solid alibi.
Good.
She'd been at her boyfriend's house with him and his mom the night of the murders. In spite of this, Nancy's not returning to Miramonte in the fall seemed to confirm everyone's suspicions that she was guilty.
Oh, that's fucked up.
Rumors kept
flying.
They said, you know, she was part of some satanic cult. Mm-hmm. Her boyfriend had access to a Pinto that matched the description. He didn't. That was not a real thing. It was just, you know.
Rumors.
Rumor mills a-flying. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, not fun for her.
I bet it wasn't.
To be ostracized and accused of
murder.
Literal murder. No one in Orinda wanted to believe that one of their own could have committed such a heinous crime. Unfortunately for them, it was looking more and more likely that it was exactly the case. Kirsten's parents believed that their daughter's killer was a fellow student and that someone knew who it was but was staying silent to protect them. At that point in time, officers were running out of leads and steam, with Captain Stan Garvin sharing 4 months into the investigation that, quote, all it has led to is frustration. To have any success, we're going to have to get a break. We got a lot of information, but nothing of value.
Well, and that's wild because, I mean, the guy saw her.
Yeah. A couple people did.
You know?
Yeah. There was one of the neighbors that was at the Arnold's house when Kirsten showed up, apparently had said something to, not Kirsten, the suspect.
Uh-huh.
Like, because I guess she had been, she said she'd had trouble getting her car started.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, and I find it interesting that Kirsten was like, my friend got weird on me. So it to me sounds like she knew her.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Ah, yes, there we go. Nothing of value as far as evidence-wise. And there wasn't a lot of physical. Apparently, they found a knife at the scene or near it, but it was not the actual murder weapon.
Oh, just random knife.
Just a knife outside.
All right, well.
That's always an alarming thing to discover.
Just a wild knife.
Just a wild knife.
A wild knife.
A feral knife. A feral.
Write that down. That's a good one.
Send it to me immediately. Thank you. A feral knife. Mm-hmm. Just literally.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
that is concerning. Like, potential murder weapon aside, why is there a knife?
Who knows?
In somebody's yard that is unrelated to the crime?
Yeah.
I don't love it. But they had really nothing
to go on.
No evidence, really, aside from the fact that
the eyewitness
this 15-year-old girl was murdered in a neighbor's front yard, and people had seen her, but apparently had no idea who she was.
Okay.
But Kirsten seemed to.
Yeah.
So around this time, the local police reached out to the FBI to build a profile of their suspect, which was, I believe, relatively new at the time, because it was 1984. So while the police waited for the profile to come back, Art and Barrett Costas, tired of the lack of movement in their daughter's case, used a little bit of the reward money to hire a private investigator named Elliot Friedman to see what, if anything, he could dig up. Initially, Friedman believed that the murder had been brought on by a drug-fueled rage, or that the killer had made advances towards Kirsten and killed her after getting rejected.
Okay. Could be.
Of this theory, Friedman said that a young lesbian in Orinda at the time, quote, could have a big brand on her forehead, and that her motive had likely been fear of humiliation. He looked into the alibis provided by all of the major suspects that police had interviewed, but they all checked out. Except for one.
Uh-oh. Is that where you're leaving it?
Yeah.
They all checked out. Except for one. All right.
Except for one.
Well, we're going to pick up on that next week.
Sure are. Yeah.
Yeah. So either Kirsten did know her, or because she thought it was the secret Bobby Sock thing. You know, and maybe she didn't know the girl, but she would probably say, thinking that the girl's part of the group, oh, my friend that picked me up.
Yeah.
And, you know, just, she wouldn't say this girl.
Just easier so you don't have to explain the full thing. Like,
right.
When you talk about someone you hooked up with, you sometimes call them your ex just because you're like, you don't need to know every single detail.
Right.
It's not relevant.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a big area. It's, you know.
Yeah.
She could be from any number of places.
Yeah, it's just like the little suburbs, like a little cluster of suburbs.
I mean, Oakland's right there. Mm-hmm. Berkeley's right there. San Francisco's right there.
Yep.
I mean, she could be...
Yeah, it was from...
Pleasant Hill. I mean, there's just so many places she could be from that are close.
Walnut Creek. And I think that's where they took her. The hospital was in Walnut Creek.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, I don't... Orinda is small, but not that small. I think as of now, it has like somewhere around like 20,000 people.
Yeah, it's pretty small.
Yeah. I mean, comparatively to everywhere nearby. Yeah.
Yeah.
And back then it was less.
Yeah.
Less people.
Because my grandma lived in Moraga.
Oh, yeah, right there.
So, yeah.
That's usual. Mm-hmm. Right there. Yes. Wild. Hold on to your butts next week, because holy shit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, I'm going to go now.
Okay. Because
we don't have sources or nothing.
Not today. You got to wait till next time. And also, there are fucking so many sources.
So today's tale is tragic, to say the least. But before I get there, we have to have a little history lesson.
Okay.
Because today I'm taking us to New York City and the Street of Lights to talk about the tragic death of Olive Thomas.
Ooh.
So Broadway is just the name of a street, but not just any street. When you hear the word Broadway, most every American's first thought is the theater.
Yes.
Arguably one of the most famous streets in the world. And New York City itself. People come from all over to see world-class theater shows on Broadway.
It's true.
Like many other historic parts of New York, Broadway's origins trace back to the early colonial days of the Dutch and the Native Americans before them. As the Europeans arrived and settled in the area, they made use of an existing, the existing Native American trails in the area. What we now know as Broadway was, before the arrival of the Europeans, the Wiccoquaskek Trail, used by the Algonquin tribes who used to live on the east bank of the Hudson River.
Okay.
The Dutch established the new Dutch Amsterdam colony, and the trail became a major Dutch north-south main thoroughfare.
Okay.
Early in the 17th century, the road, which the Dutch used to drive their livestock through the colony, was muddy as fuck. It was 80 feet wide.
Oh.
So they called the broad road Breadway.
Oh.
Broadway.
Okay.
So, and that stuck.
Sure did.
She stuck. So, for years, the road was a filthy mess. Hogs could be found rummaging in the streets while pirates frequented the taverns. Yet, as the main gathering place of the city, it attracted rich and poor alike, and the theater first became popular in New York in 1750.
Oh, okay.
Fast forward to the late 1800s, New York was competing in theater popularity with the top cities of the world, like Paris and London. With the arrival of the electric light in 1880, Broadway saw its first electric billboard in 1892.
Wow.
Much fucking fancy.
It's a lot earlier than I expected mm-hmm. that to have happened.
Now let's fast forward a little bit to the early 1900s.
Okay.
And the Ziegfeld Follies.
Ah, yeah.
If you're unfamiliar with the Follies, think Moulin Rouge.
Yes.
Producer Florence Edward Ziegfeld Jr. was inspired to start an American version after a trip to Europe in the early 1900s, and it was his wife, who was a French singer named Anna Held, who he met while there. She suggested that they create an American version of the Parisian Follies Bergères. So back to New York they went, and the Ziegfeld Follies opened to rave reviews at the Jardin de Paris Theater in 1907. Many a silent film starlet started her career, words are hard, mm-hmm. as a showgirl in the Follies, which brings us to my muse for this story, and that is Olive Thomas. Her death would be cited as one of the first major Hollywood scandals,
ooh.
And the press coverage of it was one of the first examples of the media sensationalism related to a major Hollywood star.
Oh.
So, Oliva Duffy was born October 20th, 1894, in Charleroi, Pennsylvania, the eldest of three children born to Rena and James Duffy, both of whom were of Irish descent. James, who was a steelworker, was tragically killed in a work-related accident in 1906, so Rena and the three children moved to McKees Rocks, Pennsylvania, to be near her family. Rena got a job in a local factory, so Olive and her young brothers, James and William, would stay with their grandparents while she worked. In 1909, 15-year-old Olive left school to help her mom support the family, which was not uncommon back then. And she got a job at Joseph Horn's department store in Pittsburgh, where she earned $2.75 a week selling gingham. Then in 1911, 16-year-old Oliva met and married a man named Bernard Krug Thomas. The young couple were married on April 1st, 1911, and lived with his parents in McKees Rocks for the first 6 months of their marriage, then moved into their own apartment. Bernard worked as a clerk at the Pressed Steel Car Company while Olive stayed home and take care of the house. They didn't have kids, but Olive wanted more. The marriage wouldn't last too long, with the couple separating 2 years later in 1913, and shortly after separating, she went to New York to visit an aunt, and once she got to the big city and saw the excitement of New York, she made the decision to never go back to Pennsylvania or to her husband. They were divorced on September 25th, 1915. She did keep his last name, though.
Fair.
And she would, once she got to New York, she started going by Olive. She was born Oliva.
Okay.
She became Olive. So Bernard would, much later in 1931, give an interview to the Pittsburgh Press detailing his marriage to Olive, saying that the cause of their demise was her ambition, her desire to obtain a life of luxury and improve her station.
Shut up.
So once Olive settled in with her aunt, she took another clerk job at a department store in Harlem, but she knew, as many young women a la Carrie Bradshaw do, that she wanted more from New York. She was going to be a star. And being a department store clerk was not going to be enough to satisfy her wild spirit.
And I can see why she was gorgeous.
Uh-huh.
Good Lord. She looks like Jodie Foster in this photo.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Once described as having the face of an angel and the mouth of a sailor, Olive entered a contest in 1911, the most beautiful girl in New York. It was being put on by artist Howard Chandler Christie, and she won. As a result of becoming the most beautiful girl in New York, Olive began to pose for various artists, several, and pretty quickly established her career as an artist's model. So back then, yes, there were photographs, but in that time, artists did sketches. Think of the Vargas girls and Erte and
Gibson girls.
Yes.
All that.
It was all like sketches of women. I mean, colored sketches, but. So she posed for several now famous artists of the time, Harrison Fisher, Raphael Kirschner, Penryn Stanislaw, and Haskell Coffin. She was also featured on many magazine covers, including the Saturday Evening Post. Before long, she caught the eye of Florence Ziegfeld Jr. and joined his Ziegfeld Follies. Although several men claimed credit for her success with the Follies, including Harrison Fisher, Olive would later dispute them all, saying that she just walked right up and asked for the job. Either way, she made her showgirl debut June 21st, 1915. Olive was an overnight sensation, and her popularity in the Follies led to her being cast in Ziegfeld's more risque show, Midnight Frolic.
Yeah.
Now, the Frolic was an after-hours show.
Yeah,
it was. It started at midnight on the rooftop garden of the New Amsterdam Theater. Ziegfeld pulled out all the stops for Frolic. He mechanized the stage so that it rolled back to reveal a dance floor, and he installed glass walkways that would allow the chorus girls to dance above the patrons seated below.
Ooh, how lewd.
Now, the show was targeted for the more famous male patrons who had plenty of money to spend on the beautiful young chorus girls. The girls, including Olive, would shimmy down the glass walkway above the audience, and although they were reportedly told to wear their bloomers, the rule was not followed very closely.
Again, how lewd.
Uh-huh. Olive, who was a patron favorite, got many expensive gifts from her admirers, and it was rumored that German ambassador Albrecht von Bernstorff had given her a $10,000 string of pearls.
Good golly.
Mm-hmm. Olive would have an affair with Ziegfeld, as many of the girls did. He was married at the time, but not to his original wife. It was another actress. He was known to have had many affairs with many a Ziegfeld girl, but it was Olive that would eventually end their affair because Florence refused to leave his wife to marry her.
Rude.
So while appearing in the Follies, Olive still did her modeling, and Alberto Vargas, best known for the Vargas girls, was Ziegfeld's artist in residence, and he painted many stars of the Ziegfeld stage. And he would later immortalize Olive in a portrait he painted of her from memory after her death, which I will get there. And he titled it Memory of Olive Thomas, or The Lotus Eater, which was noted on the label in the back of the completed work. The portrait depicts Olive nude from the waist up, covering her left breast with her hand while holding a rose with her right hand above her upturned face. Like you would eat grapes like that. Yep. Isn't that gorgeous? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the painting remained in his personal collection until his death in 1982.
Oh, wow.
Vargas called Olive Thomas one of the most beautiful brunettes that Ziegfeld ever glorified.
I could see why.
Yeah.
I can see.
Yeah. So Olive's star was on the rise. In July 1916, she signed a contract with the International Film Company, making her on-screen debut in episode 10 of a film series. It's like a series, kind of like, you know, like a TV show, I guess, would be now.
Yeah.
Called Beatrice Fairfax. Then in 1917, at 23 years old, she made her full-length feature debut in A Girl Like That for Paramount Pictures and would sign with Triangle Pictures later that same year. However, Olive was hiding a giant secret. She had married Hollywood hottie and silent film star Mary Pickford's younger brother, Jack, the previous year.
This fucking nerd?
Mm-hmm. So...
Yeah, I get it, girl.
21-year-old Jack was also a burgeoning silent film star. He was a super fucking hottie. He had that whole Pete Davidson thing going on.
Yeah, he's lurch-shaped, which is my bread and butter.
Yeah, is that the picture of him leaning against the bar with a hat?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's super Pete Davidson. Like, yeah. I get it.
He's like the turn of the century Pete
yep.
Davidson.
Yep, 100%.
Also, from a similar area.
Yeah, yeah, he's super cute. Mm. So, he and Olive had met at a beach cafe on Santa Monica Pier in late 1916 and eloped on October 25th of that same year. Initially, Jack and Olive kept their marriage a secret because she didn't want the public to assume her star was rising due to her association with the infamous Pickford family.
Fair.
Mary Pickford was a huge silent film star at that point already. So she did not want it publicly known so much that she never took his last name. But the couple was not exactly discreet. They weren't. The press picked up on the marriage pretty quickly. Jack and Olive were very much cut from the same cloth. They were both super party pants with personalities that bordered on hedonistic. Ooh. They were prone to sexual promiscuity, not always with each other. The Los Angeles Times of in 1917 stated of Olive, "Miss Thomas has a reputation for seeking action and plenty of it."
Get it, girl.
So she was, So screenwriter and director of the time, Francis Marion, later commented on the couple's wild party lifestyle, saying, "Two innocent-looking children, they were the gayest, wildest brats who ever stirred the stardust on Broadway. Both were talented, but they were much more interested in playing the roulette of life than in concentrating on their careers."
Well, they were what, in their
20s? They were 21 and 23.
Okay. That's exactly what mm-hmm. your 20s are for. That is timeless.
Yeah, it's timeless.
Also, he kind of reminds me of Crispin Glover.
Yeah.
Like that?
Yeah.
It's probably the hair, but he's definitely got a Crispin Glover
super
vibe.
Super hottie party pants, both of them.
Yeah.
And they were beautiful together.
Yeah. Here's one of those couples you see walking down the street and you're like, fuck you both.
Yeah, right?
Leave something for the rest of us.
Right?
As if so, I'd be outside, though.
Yeah. So they both cheated. They both partied. They both, you know.
Is it cheating if you're both doing it and you both know about it?
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. You're going to do what you're going to do. So,
right. So Jack and Olive spent a lot of time on opposite coasts due to their careers, which didn't help their tumultuous and toxic relationship. They would have giant, dramatic battles. Then Jack would shower Olive with expensive gifts. I'm sure they would have makeup sex, and all was well again until the cycle started over.
Yeah.
After 2 years of working, drinking, partying, and fighting, Jack and Olive decided to take a trip to Paris to reconnect. So on August 12th, 1920, they set sail aboard the RMS Imperator.
Sure.
And headed to France. And that is where shit would go really bad and end in Olive's death.
Oh, no.
On September 5th, Jack and Olive spent the evening partying in the Montparnasse quarter of Paris. There's a lot of booze. There was a lot of blow. And that evening, they got back to their room at the Hotel Ritz around 3 a.m., Jack went straight to bed to pass the fuck out, but Olive had quite the headache, so she was going to stay up for a bit and take something for her head.
Okay.
So she stumbled to the bathroom, drunk and tired, in search of something, aspirin. When she got to the bathroom, her drunk girl brain was like, hey, let's write a letter to Mom. Which she did.
I mean, yeah, whomst among us?
Then she grabbed the medicine bottle that she thought was the liquid pain reliever.
Oh, no.
Took a huge swig, like I said, of what she thought was the liquid pain reliever. Well, Olive hadn't read the label, which was in French anyway, so it wouldn't have mattered. But if she had been able to read French, and she had checked the label, she would have known the flask that she picked up had a poison warning on it.
Oh, no.
Well, the realization that she had done fucked up was immediate based on the taste. and she quickly screamed, "Oh my God!" loud enough to wake her very drunk and passed out husband. So Jack comes running into the bathroom just in time to catch his wife as she fell towards the floor with the bottle of poison in her hand. Olive had unfortunately, mistakenly, taken a large swig from a bottle of mercury bichloride, which was then called corrosive subliminate.
No.
And it is what Jack used topically to treat his syphilitic ulcers.
Oh, it just gets worse.
It's his syphilis medicine for his junk, but it's the topical.
Yeah, it's not for ingesting.
So this was bad.
Oh, boy.
He was really bad, and he knew it. So Jack, who sobered up real fucking fast, tried to dilute the poison by having her chug water and induce vomiting with raw eggs. He would take raw eggs, and he shoved, you know, drank, yeah. had her drink them to get her to puke, which she did. He also called for a doctor who rushed to the room and pumped her stomach 3 times, but the decline was fairly rapid. So at 9 a.m., a terrified and sick Olive was taken to Neuilly Hospital for treatment, where the doctors did everything they could to try and save her, but they had little hope outside of Olive's desire to live. And even though she kept assuring Jack that she would get better, her organs were slowly shutting down. Meanwhile, the press caught wind of what had happened and had a field day. They began to report on the various rumors that had started to go around regarding the incident. Some papers said that Olive had attempted suicide after having a fight with Jack over his alleged infidelities, while others said she attempted suicide after discovering that he had given her syphilis. There were also rumors that Olive had a drug addiction and that she and Jack had been involved in, quote, champagne and cocaine orgies, or that Jack had tricked her into drinking poison in an attempt to murder her to collect her insurance money. However, Jack's former brother-in-law, Owen Moore, was out with them that night, and he denied the rumors, saying that Olive was not suicidal and that she and Jack had not fought at all that evening.
Okay.
On September 10th, 1920, Jack, who never left his wife's side, asked Olive how she was feeling, to which she replied, "Pretty weak, but I'll be all right in a little while. Don't worry, darling."
Oh.
And those were the last words she ever spoke before her kidneys stopped functioning.
Ugh.
Olive Thomas died that day at just 25 years old.
Ugh.
I know. The newspapers reported that Olive had committed suicide immediately, and Jack responded to these claims, insisting that Olive was happy to be alive and would never have committed suicide, saying, "Olive and I were the greatest pals on earth. Her death is a ghastly mistake." He also denied the rumors of the wild partying and cocaine. Then came the rumors of murder. The police did do an investigation, and an autopsy was performed. The doctor that performed the autopsy stated that Olive Thomas's death was attributed to acute nephritis caused by mercury bichloride absorption, and on September 13th, 1920, her death was officially ruled accidental. So, Jack brought his wife's body back to the U.S. via ship, because that's, you know, it's 1920, and was so despondent over his wife's death that he almost committed suicide on the way home.
Oh.
He attempted to jump overboard, but was stopped before he could jump. On September 29th, 1920, Olive's funeral was held at St. Thomas Episcopal Church in New York City, and according to the New York Times, police escorts were needed at the event because the entire church was crowded with hundreds of fellow actors and the other invited attendees, as well as a horde of fans standing outside trying to get a glimpse of probably anyone that would have been there.
Yeah.
So the church was so crowded that it was reported that several women fainted during the ceremony and several men had their hats crushed in the rush to view the casket.
Oof.
Olive Thomas was then interred in a crypt at the Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx under the last name Pickford. It's a big mausoleum and it says Pickford. Jack would go on to marry and divorce 2 more times before dying himself on January 3rd, 1933 in Paris from progressive multiple neuritis due to his alcoholism. By most accounts, Olive was the love. He was only like, he was young still too, I think.
Yeah. He wasn't too much older than her.
He was 21.
Yeah.
In 1920.
Anyway, yeah, I forgot to write down how old he was, but he was young. He was like in his
30s.
Yeah. Anyway, so by most accounts, Olive was the love of Jack's life, but his family did not approve of her, with his sister Mary later saying, "I regret to say that none of us approved of the marriage at the time. Mother thought Jack was too young, and Lottie and I felt that Olive, being in musical comedy, belonged to an alien world." Lottie was their sister, by the way. Ollie had all the rich, eligible men of the social world at her feet. She had been deluged with proposals from her own world of theater as well, which was not at all surprising. The beauty of Olive Thomas is legendary. The girl had the loveliest violet-blue eyes I have ever seen. They were fringed with long, dark lashes that seemed darker because of the delicate, translucent pallor of her skin. I would understand why Florence Ziegfeld never forgave Jack for taking her away from the Follies. She and Jack were madly in love with one another, but I always thought of them as a couple of children playing together. So...
He was 36.
36, yeah.
I had to look.
So, clearly, film stars thought very differently of stage stars. Because yes. She was, yes, being in musical comedy belonged to an alien world.
No, okay, Mary.
Yeah, I can hear it in her transatlantic accent, you know.
Yes, I'd attempt it, but mm-hmm. I'm too tired for regular words this evening. But yeah, she's like,
Mm-hmm. So.
Stage girls.
I know, right?
Calm down. She was a silent film star. Mary Pickford. She transition, but she started.
She was a silent film star. That's she was. And yeah. She was downplaying the theater.
Yeah, like, girl.
So she must, I don't know that much of whether she, but everyone started in vaudeville usually.
Right, calm down, Mary.
But, I mean, hey, Olive had several films under her, yeah. You know, I'm just going to get there now. So, at just the beginning of the Roaring Twenties, an age of decadence, which Olive would have loved.
Yes. I am sad that she didn't get to live through that.
I know, right? So.
Imagine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, little Miss Party Pants.
Meeting up with Zelda.
Right? Olive Thomas, the most beautiful girl in New York, with countless famous sketch modeling sessions and 23 silent films to her credit, was a young rising star that burned out too quickly. But her story doesn't end here. Ooh. Oh, no. Because Olive is one of the most famous ghosts on Broadway. Uh-huh. It's a double whammy, guys.
I love when that happens.
So... By the 1930s, the Roaring Twenties, obviously over, you know, the Great Depression, terrible. The New Amsterdam Theater had fallen into disrepair. She changed hands multiple times and was several shitty movie theaters and all kinds of other shit like that. But unfortunately, the beautiful Art Deco building was, she wasn't cared for properly. And by the late 70s, she was dilapidated. And by the 90s, it was even worse. Chunks of plaster had fallen from the roof and the first balcony. Entire sections of the roof had fallen.
Oh, no.
Onto the floor. There were dead cats in the basement and mushrooms. Christ. Yeah, mushrooms were growing up through the auditorium floor. But then...
Oh, no.
Disney stepped in and they saw a diamond in the rough.
Okay.
Pun very much intended. Aladdin, everybody. By the mid-90s, the renovations had begun, and so did the sightings of a beautiful young woman in a green beaded flapper dress. She would walk across the stage or throughout the theater, then vanish. So Disney took over the New Amsterdam, and that is where all of their live theater shows are done.
Oh.
To this day.
Okay.
To this day.
Okay.
So... In one of the most notable stories, a security guard had called and woken up Dana Amendola, the vice president of operations for Disney Theatricals, in the middle of the night, scared shitless because he had been doing his rounds when he felt someone tap him on the shoulder. Understandably freaked the fuck out, he turned around to see a young woman in a green beaded dress walk through the wall out onto 41st Street. Amendola has a story himself. According to him, a group of Disney staffers were sitting in an office discussing the Oscar-winning film The Artist, which had been set in the silent film era.
Got it.
They then being in the Amsterdam, wondered and started to talk about how many of the Follies girls had become stars. Someone had mentioned that Olive Thomas had, but then somebody said, but the real star of the silent area was Mary Pickford.
Uh-oh.
And one, someone said, I wonder what Olive Thomas would think of the artist. Right after that, a large stack of DVDs on a nearby table flew into the air and crashed across the room. They all sat in stunned silence, and Amendola later said that stack had been there for a long time, and there was no obvious way they could have fallen, let alone flew across the room. They didn't fall straight down as CDs would have done. They went flying about 3 feet across the room and hit a wall. This was witnessed by several people. They didn't even make the connection to Olive right away, but when they told me about it, I did. Mm-hmm. Another story from Amendola. Shortly after the opening of Aladdin in 2014, an audience member came up to one of the ushers during a performance and asked if she could have a booster seat for her child. We don't like to interrupt a show, so we waited until the intermission and came to her with a booster. But we found she already had one. When we asked where she had gotten it, she said a lady at the back of the theater had gestured to where they were. Now, we don't have a woman at the back of the house who does that in the middle of a show. We checked, and none of the staff had done it. So you can take that how you like it, but it was kind of freaky. He followed it up with, this has been going on for 20 years that I remember. I think she likes the attention. Olive Thomas has shown herself so frequently that Amendola has placed photographs of her at every entrance to the theater so that the actors can greet her when they arrive for work each day, which is a belief that keeps her mischief to a minimum.
Okay.
Most are visible only to Disney employees who have a ritual of blowing a kiss or touching the picture frame as they enter and leave, as well as saying, hello, Olive, and goodbye, Olive, each time. And it's to this day...
It's one thing about the theater. There are many a superstition.
Yep. They say hello as they go into the theater, and they either kiss or, and they do it on their way out. And to this day, audiences who enter through the main entrance on 42nd Street can see her, too. Olive Thomas is the last photo on the right side as you enter the theater.
Aww.
And that is the tragic death and haunting of Olive Thomas.
That was a very good one.
Right?
I had somehow never heard of that before.
Yeah, and she just, I see little snippets of her films. She's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Oh, and that Vargas.
That painting.
Mm-hmm.
Is insane.
Yeah, and he kept that in his personal collection until the day he died.
I can see why.
And then it was auctioned off to a collector.
It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That's like something I want both a print of and quite possibly tattooed on my body.
It's gorgeous.
It is,
I know.
Beautiful.
I know. She was beautiful.
She really was. And the thing is, like, that painting is so beautiful, but it still doesn't do her justice.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit, she was beautiful.
Yeah. And it's just, she just, drunk girl grabbed the wrong bottle.
Ugh.
I know.
So upsetting.
Yeah.
And I also, know. We did it again.
Oh, so here we go. My sources are playbill.com. 500,000 wikis, findagrave.com, thenewvictorytheater.org, Tim Dolan, The Guardian, David Taylor, museumofnewyorkcity.org, Namisha Bhatt, medium.com, Heather Monroe, americanmusical.wordpress.com, barrybradford.com, and thenewamsterdamtheater.motherfucking.com. And there you have it.
That I did not know
there
that
you
story.
Have it.
Like old Hollywood, but not Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like that whole thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, they always say hello to her on the way in and goodbye to her on the way out.
I mean,
yeah.
If it's going to keep her mischief at a minimum,
yeah.
Do it. That, the DVD thing, though, that is. Mm-hmm. So creepy.
Oh, yeah.
So creepy.
Yeah.
I, this, normally I would just be like, is just me and my ADHD and not paying attention. Uh-huh. But this morning, I had made a little cup of rice for Hawkeye. Mm-hmm. Put it in the microwave. Microwaved it. And then the microwave beeped to let me know it was done. Great. Mm-hmm. I was doing something else. I'm like, I'll get it out in a second. I'm going to finish doing these dishes. And it needs to cool down anyway because he will burn his mouth if mm-hmm. I give it to him now. I turn around and I open the microwave and I go to take the rice out. Mm-hmm. And it was not in there.
Oh.
And I was like, hey. And it was on the counter next to, like, where all my utensils are. And I was like, oh, did I just literally turn the microwave on for a minute with nothing inside? Because that would not shock me.
Right.
Because my Adderall has not kicked in yet. So, yeah, okay. But I picked up the rice.
And it was hot.
It was hot.
Oh, boy.
I had not taken it out. Like, I gaslit myself so hard. I'm like, maybe you did. But if I had, but the thing is, if I had taken, because my microwave, if you wait too long, much like Tubi, it will scream. Much like Tubi, it will do something about it. It's like, hey, you're taking too long, and it'll beep at me uh-huh. again. It just did the one. Uh-huh. It just did the one beep. And I have no idea what happened.
Well.
And it was very jarring. I was like, We're just gonna move past it for now.
Yeah, we are.
And not think about it. Whomstever.
Thanks.
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 I think.
Sure.
I don't know. Were you hungry? Did you want rice? It was
right?
hot.
Right?
So that was... Huh. Yeah. Maybe I need to put up a picture of Olive Thomas in my kitchen.
Aw, I love her.
I do too.
I love her. I love their story.
Same. Her she Jack, seemed like she would have been
hottie patotties.
Really fun.
Yeah.
They would have made gorgeous children.
Oh, God.
Or hideous children.
Sometimes that happens.
It's a gamble. Like
sometimes that happens.
Two really hot people have babies.
I was concerned about Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, to be honest.
That is.
But they lucked out, because sometimes you have people that are that beautiful,
yeah.
they make monsters.
They get like, wonky
right?
recessive traits
right?
from both, and you're like, whoa!
Like the Habsburg chin or something, you know?
Well, that was inbreeding, but...
Yeah.
I'd say allegedly, but...
No, it's not alleged. There's no allegedly about it. It was not. Inbreeding.
And also, what are they going to do?
For centuries of inbreeding.
What are the Habsburgs going to do to me? Nothing. The deed.
There's some.
Are there still some that exist?
Oh, yeah. There's Habsburgs left, but without the traits.
Yeah.
Because they're not inbred anymore, but there are Habsburgs.
Okay.
They're just not...
But still.
Inbreeding.
You can't come for me, because...
No.
We all know.
No.
We all know.
Like the king of Bavaria or some shit like that is a Habsburg.
I'm
making things up, but not really, because I know one of them is. I just don't know where.
You could have just left it at that, and I would have been like, yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
I would have not questioned you.
And it does sound right.
It
so,
does.
I mean,
and I'm still not questioning you. I'm still not questioning you, because...
But don't quote me.
So. I don't know, but yeah, we did it.
We done it.
We did done do it.
We done it. So y'all know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe. Share, share, share. If you'd like some exclusive motherfucking content, go become a patron on our La Patron.
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's going to be the December's.
Yeah.
This is going to be good.
Oh, yeah.
It's in a first, kind of a part two.
Kind of a part two.
To last month.
Yeah, it is. So. Yes.
I'm not
kind. If you're not there, sign up and catch up.
Not kind of. It is.
It is. It is. It is. A part two.
Part two.
It's an in addition to.
Yeah.
So,
extension.
An extension of.
Because if we had done it last week, you would have never made it to where you needed to go.
Nope. And you guys would have had a three-hour Patreon.
Yeah, I was going to say, we may have still been here recording it now. Had
so
we done
many
it at one
things
time.
To say. So, yeah. Well, until next time, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Bye.
Bye. Mwah! Hats off to the fuck you club. I mean, we'll get to yours next time. We'll so today to we're just going to take it old school.
Oh, I'm going
to
say fucking, what was it?
Mercury bichloride? Yeah. Fuck
Henry
you.
Kissinger.
Fuck you, bro.
Forever and always.
Fuck you, Bob. Fuck you, Ted. Kimberly can't read. Fuck you, Gwyneth.
Sure can't. No, thank you.
Yeah. There we go.
That's it. There is a very hilarious video of David Tennant singing an improvised song, I believe, as Gwyneth Paltrow. And I have to show it to you once we hit stop because it's so fucking good.
Oh my God. All right. Well, I'm going to go press the button.
Okay.
Because we are left our own devices.
Oh, it's always a risky little game.